All right, we're going to start in 1 minute, so I'm going to give a little bit of bonus here. So everybody can leave here. Hopefully, I'm going to guess maybe saying that this will be the one session where you learned a little bit of Hebrew. So we've been greeting everyone very wrong so far at the conference. I talked to Sean about it, and he still didn't correct everybody. But this is a conference where we're talking about Genesis, so which was written in Hebrew. So we should have the proper greeting for each other during the conference. When you see each other before lunch, the proper greeting is Boker Tov. So everybody say it with me, Boker Tov. Boker means morning, Tov means good. If you had a great night's sleep last night, you can say Boker Gadol for a great morning. So Boker Tov is good morning. See anybody after lunch, you could technically say good day, Yom Tov. Nobody really says that, though. If you see somebody after lunch, it is Shalom. So, shalom. When you see anybody the rest of the day today in greeting, you say shalom. You see anybody tomorrow morning, you go up to them and you say Boker Tov. So, a conference where we're talking about Genesis. We should at least have the right greeting. So, I'm Sean Wilson, and I pastor a church in New Orleans, Louisiana. On top of that, I have a YouTube channel called Rev Reads, where I review books on free grace, justice, trying to start doing some Roman Catholic evangelism in the channel, and my fourth category is Bible translation. So those are the type of books and videos I do. If you would like to support seeing more free grace books and content out there on YouTube, subscribe to Rev Reads, and whenever you see a free grace book that I got on there, spend 30 seconds watching the video. It will give it another video hit, which will make it just a little bit more likely in the YouTube algorithm to get suggested first. My goal is that if somebody were to search on YouTube and say Faith Alone or Grace Alone, like I want, if somebody searches Faith Alone on YouTube, I want Bob's Faith Alone in 100 Verses, first thing that shows up. And so if you want to see that out there, just a little way to get into that YouTube world more, subscribe to Rev Reads. If you see the videos come up, even if you're not the biggest fan of my work, watch it for 30 seconds and help it get out there a little more. There's a handout. So let's have a word of prayer, and then we're going to look at Genesis and the subject of death. I think you got the whole stack there. So, yeah. All right. So let's have a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, I thank you for this day that you've made. I pray that we will rejoice and be glad in it, Lord. And this is just not a good day, but this is a great day because we have the opportunity to fellowship among your people and not just fellowship together, but fellowship around your word. And I pray that through this time that we're going to spend in Genesis and in Revelation, that we will be able to have a clearer and more biblically faced hope for eternity. And we can see how masterfully your word is with the way that the beginning matches up with the end. And in Jesus' name I pray, amen. When I was in seminary, I was tasked with interviewing a religious leader who was from a faith that was not along the lines of the Protestant tradition. So I went with a couple other students, and we interviewed a rabbi at one of the largest synagogues in our nation's capital. The experience was eye-opening, to say the least. The attention that this synagogue paid to the Torah, both in their structure of reading and also their care for the scrolls, was impressive. Their devotion to so many of the laws and traditions was a little bit unexpected for me, because this was a very progressive or liberal synagogue, so I didn't think they would hold that fast to the law, but they really did. But what intrigued me the most in the interview process and really sort of knocked me back on my heels was the rabbi's view of Abraham and the afterlife. The question that was asked to the rabbi escapes my memory, but his answer to the question was instantly burned into my long-term memory. As the rabbi looked at us and he said, "I don't believe Abraham existed." And this just sort of hit me like a profound, like a slap in the face. Like, what do you mean you don't believe Abraham existed? And he's like, "Yeah, I don't even really think the God of the Hebrew Bible existed either." And that's not to say he was an atheist, more of an agnostic. He just wasn't sure if there was a God. He simply believed that man ceases to exist after death. And so I'm like, I can get how Jews don't believe in Abraham or don't believe in, you know, the God of the Bible. I can understand that. But dude, you're a rabbi. Like, how do you not believe in Abraham? And he basically told us that he teaches the law. He is passionate about the law because he believes that the Jews held the best path to the best life on this earth. And this earth is all there is. We will cease to exist when we die. And he believes that he has discovered that view on the afterlife based on the Hebrew Bible. The Hebrew Bible does not talk about life after death. And this sent me on a personal journey, a search through the Bible, specifically the Old Testament. Have Christians misunderstood the Old Testament all this time? Do we Christians take our theology of the New Testament and illegitimately add it into the Old Testament? And so what I wanted to do was see the Old Testament without bringing my New Testament perspective into the picture, something obviously easier said than done. So this led to a study on the occurrences of death, Sheol, heaven, and more in the Old Testament. You should be glad you're not part of my first church because we had a study, I think lasted like 3 or 4 months, where I tracked through death in the Old Testament. It was pretty large when it first started and kind of smaller by the time we got to Malachi. So look through everything the Old Testament has to say about the subject of death. And one of the major conclusions I drew from that study was the importance specifically of the book of Genesis on our understanding of life after death. Genesis sets the entire stage for how a person should view their life after we leave these mortal bodies. Genesis is what prepares us for a proper hope for eternity. Genesis is what sets the scene for what we will eventually see in the book of Revelation. Death in the beginning predicts and foreshadows life in the end. And as an added bonus, pairing together Genesis and the book of Revelation, you can clearly see how there is one author over all of the books and one Holy Spirit who is inspiring the entire process. So let's begin by talking about death and the end of man. The Hebrew word for death, the word muth, occurs 85 times in Genesis, along with several other terms that are used to describe death. So death is everywhere in the book of Genesis. You can come in if you're out there in the hallway. But interestingly enough, death is not presented as the default of man in the Genesis account in the beginning. In Genesis chapters 1 through 3, death is described more as an intruder. Death is a punishment. Death is not a gift that God gives for us that one day we will leave this world. God did not tell Adam and Eve, you know, enjoy the time you have on this earth. One day, though, you will be free from this earth and you will enjoy eternity with me in heaven. Instead, Adam was told to cultivate the garden, to go on walks with God, to eat freely, except for that one exception. But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. So death was not natural. Death is unnatural. Death is the punishment. Death is the disturber. Adam was not made to die. Adam was created to live. And it was only the introduction of sin and disobedience that brought death into this world. So we see that Adam was made in the image of God. Adam was made to dwell with God and loving fellowship with God. And I think to me, the key to the first three chapters of Genesis is that Adam was specifically made to dwell with God, not in heaven, but Adam was made to dwell with God on earth. You can even see that with Adam's initial name. Man was not named Shemaimim. We were not made for the heavens, but Adam was made. He was named after the ground. God formed Adam out of the ground. That is the Adama. And so he named him Adam or Adam. So the natural path for those who were made in the image of God is to experience unending life with God on the ground, on the Adama. We are descendants of Adam on the ground. Death should never be seen as a gift that unites a man with his creator, because we were not made to live with God in heaven, but we were made to live with God on earth. And even looking at the curse in Genesis chapter 3, one can see how physical death is an intruder on the life that God intended, and death is not the holy plan for those made in the image of God. Many see that the entrance of death following the eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is primarily a spiritual death and a separation from God. And separation from God clearly occurred when Adam and Eve partook of the fruit, but it is not spiritual death that is the emphasis in Genesis chapter 3. But how does God finish with the words of the curse? It's talking about physical death. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you are taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. The final nail in the coffin of the curse was to be the picture of physical death, that we were going to go back to that ground through which we were made. Adam and Eve's body will return to the same physical dust that God had brought them out of on the sixth day of creation. So physical death and eternal separation from our bodies in heaven is not what God intended us. God didn't intend us to die and then live with him in glory forever. Heaven is not what any person was ever made to experience for eternity. I think that's a key thought we need to have in our minds. We were not made to live in heaven with God for eternity. Leaving this world, leaving our mortal bodies is part of the curse. It is not a blessing. Every person was made for this world. And when we see that in the book of Genesis, it should logically lead us to say, well, what should be God's end goal for man? What should be God's goal for us in the abundant life? It should be life on this world. And how do we see the book of Revelation ending? But in Revelation chapter 19, the Apostle John gives the reader a vision of Jesus's return to the Adama, to the ground. Jesus comes to judge and to make war with the armies of men who have assembled around Jerusalem. And then in Revelation chapter 20, Jesus establishes his 1,000-year rule and kingdom. Is it up in heaven? No, it is here on the earth. And then following that 1,000-year millennial kingdom, what do we have in the eternal state? It is not a focus on heaven again, but it is a focus upon the new heaven and the new earth as the new Jerusalem comes down upon the earth and we will dwell with the Lord forever in this newly fashioned earth as God fully reverses all the effects of the curse in Genesis chapter 3. So the creation of man in Genesis chapter 1 through 3, what it should actually do is put in our own hearts a longing for the eternal state in Revelation 20 through 22. So I find it really interesting that the first three chapters of Genesis really look forward to the last three chapters in Revelation for God's plan for his people. Death also speaks to us a lot about the promises of God. One could read the book of Genesis and come to the conclusion that our God is not a promise-keeping God, that he is not keeping his word to his people. The reason is that we have God giving these miraculous promises to Abraham. And the promises that God gives to Abraham are just stunning. God comes to Abraham and says, "You will have a nation's worth of descendants." But how many kids did he have? He had Isaac to carry on his name. He promised that Abraham would be a blessing to all of the families on the earth. This clearly didn't happen in his lifetime because Abraham probably wasn't even aware of all of the families on the earth at that time period. And then God also promised to give Abraham a massive land inheritance. And if you actually look at the borders of that land that's promised to Abraham in Genesis, I mean, it is a huge piece of land. And Abraham ended up only owning a very small portion of that land where he buried his wife. And so this presents the reader of Genesis, if you're someone who also believes in the promises of God, kind of presents us with a problem. And that is, how can God be seen as worthy of belief in his promises when to his own friend Abraham, God didn't deliver to him all the promises that were made to him in his life. And I believe that we see the way that the promises are fulfilled to Abraham is through probably the most unexpected place I expected to go until I did this study, and that was the burial practices in Genesis. When you read through Genesis, there are an untold number of people who die in that book. I mean, Bob, he's probably running out because he's like, I just talked about this. Why do I need to hear this? All these people are dying in Genesis chapter 5. Even more people are dying in Genesis chapter 36. We have this repetition of he died, he died, he died, he died. So many deaths. And how many people are actually buried in the book of Genesis? Six. And it is the selection of those six that are pretty revealing. The first time burial is mentioned in the book of Genesis, which is this is what keyed me in on maybe that this concept is important, is that it comes up in Genesis chapter 15, verse 15. Right in the midst of God's covenant with Abraham, that God's going to provide Abraham with two things. One, a whole bunch of descendants. The second thing that God's going to provide Abraham is the land of the Kenites, the Hittites, and more. So Genesis 15, 15 says, as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. Another key phrase when it comes to death. And you will be buried at a good old age. So Abraham's burial is explicitly in this context attached to Abraham's receiving of the promised land as an inheritance of God. And it is through the children of Abraham that he will finally take possession of this land. And Abraham's future burial in peace is meant to serve as a sign of confirmation that God will fulfill the greater promises that he has made to Abraham and his descendants. So through Genesis chapter 15 and the promised burial of Abraham, we see how even in death, God is not finished fulfilling his promises to Abraham. So through Abraham's burial, God is saying to Abraham, I got more work to do on this promise that I'm giving to you. It's still coming. You may have died physically right now, but I'm not done with the promises that I am making for you. I will fulfill these promises. And I think God's specifically saying, not just through your kids, I'm going to fulfill these promises, Abraham, but I'm going to fulfill them to you specifically. So Genesis 15, 15 illuminates the importance of burial. And out of the 36 times that burial is mentioned in the book of Genesis, 13 of those 36 occurrences are found in Genesis chapter 23. Genesis 23 is all about burial, and it is about the burial of Abraham's wife, Sarah. So why put such a focus on Sarah's burial when you would assume if you're going to be highlighting anybody's actual burial, it would be Abraham's? But the focus is instead placed upon Sarah. The reason that this focus is placed upon Sarah is when is the first time that Abraham receives legal possession and legal ownership of the land that God has promised him? It is at the burial of Sarah. When Abraham receives that line, that promise, showing us that the goodness that God promised to Abraham, he's beginning to fulfill it. And how is he fulfilling that land? Actually, through the death of Sarah, through the burial of Sarah. So death is not Abraham and Sarah and his descendants are cut off from the promise, but this is how God is confirming to them, I still got work to do on what I'm going to provide for you, and I'm still going along that direction. There are four other characters that are buried in the book of Genesis, two women and two men. They are Deborah, Rachel, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, the burials of Isaac and Jacob, you know, obvious candidates for burial and why they would be mentioned. No one also is shocked at Rachel's burial. Of course, the wife of Isaac, we're going to highlight her burial. But maybe the most sort of, why is this verse in the book of Genesis? Like, I think this could be the most out of place verse in the entire book is the burial of Deborah. Deborah is first mentioned to us in Genesis 24:59, which I didn't even catch the first time it was mentioned when I was going through my own study, because Deborah's not even named the first time she comes up in Genesis 24:59. We just read about how Rebekah's nurse is traveling with her into the promised land. So Deborah goes unmentioned when she's first brought up in the narrative. And the only time Deborah is mentioned in the entire Bible by name is when she is buried. So Genesis 35 verse 8 says, did I put it in there? I did. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under a terebinth tree. So the name of it was called Elon Bakuth. So Deborah's burial was most likely mentioned in place of Rebekah. Rebekah, who was the wife of Isaac, the mother of Jacob and Esau. But we don't have Rebekah's burial mentioned. We only have Deborah's burial mentioned. So why is it that in the inspired text we skip Rebekah, who was the far more important character in the narrative, and we instead just have her nurse, Deborah? And this is a little bit of speculation here, so you just got to go with me on this one. And if you all think I'm wrong, I'm all right with that. But I think the reason that you mention Deborah and you don't mention Rebekah is that a key person was missing when Rebekah died. And that was, when Rebekah died, Jacob was not in the promised land. Remember, we just got done hearing a talk about how crazy things were going on for Jacob and Laban at that time when his mother died. And so Jacob, who will soon be named Israel, is not in the promised land. And since the next patriarch in the line was not present in God's land, we're not going to mention the burial of Rebekah because God's people are not in God's land, because Jacob is not there at that time period. But as soon as Jacob returns to the promised land in Genesis 35, we are told of the burial of Deborah, then we are told of the burial of Rachel, then we are told of the burial of Isaac. They all come up in the same chapter, one after another, and all of those burials begin to be mentioned again because Jacob is back in that promised land. So the significance of these burials in the promised land is meant to tie God's people to the promised land that God has promised to provide them through their future descendants. And then if you remember the end of the book of Genesis, we end the book with the burial of Jacob. And Jacob is almost sort of obsessed there right before he dies with wanting to not be buried in the land of Egypt, but wanting to be buried in the same place where his wife and his father and his grandfather are buried. And he wants to make sure that his body is transported up to the land that has been promised to him. And so they make big pomp and circumstance about taking Jacob's body up there because he wants to be buried in Canaan and not in the land of Egypt. And I believe that that is an act of faith on Jacob's part, because Jacob does not want to miss out on the future restoration of God's people to God's land. So what they're doing through this burial practice is they are pointing us toward the reality that God's people who have been promised this land, they are to be restored to that land. And God's people will have their final restoration to the promised land in Revelation chapter 20, when God's Messiah will come to rule and reign in God's land, and his people will be there to enjoy the peace and prosperity of the millennial kingdom. So through the burials of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their wives, they are foreshadowing the coming messianic kingdom in Revelation chapter 20, when God will restore his people to their land. Then the final way that death is spoken of in the book of Genesis is through the idea of a fellowship with their people. Now today, when a Christian dies, I know this because I've done numerous funerals. Whenever we have a brother or sister in Christ who passes away, we speak of a glorious union that person is going to have with Jesus Christ. I remember when my own mother passed away, just meditating on the glory of Psalm 23 and the idea of her who was a sheep to her shepherd now being welcomed into the home of her Lord and being seated at his table and offered a cup. And we just have that joy of life with God as as Jesus promised to his disciples that he was going to prepare a home for them in glory. So we in the church, we hope and we are looking forward to being face to face with Jesus Christ when we pass away and when we go before God and see him face to face in heaven. When we look at the patriarchs in Genesis, they, interestingly enough, never talk about a hope of seeing God following death. They instead have a different hope in the book of Genesis. The patriarchs in Genesis never talk about ascending to heaven. They never talk about being with God after death. And it appears in Genesis, and I would argue in the Old Testament as a whole, that the separation between God and man, which began in the garden, continued for mankind even following death. So the journey of those who have died, specifically those of Abraham and those of faith in Genesis, was not a journey up to heaven, but it was a journey down. As Jacob himself speaks in Genesis chapter 37, 42, and 44 of going down to a place called Sheol in the Hebrew in sorrow. Now, Sheol's translated several different ways depending upon which Bible translation you have. It's either translated as a burial place or a pit or as hell itself in a lot of English Bibles. Now, I believe that Sheol is a proper name for the underworld from the Hebrew perspective. Sheol should not be seen as hell, but it is to be seen as a shadowy waiting place. The Israelites who possess faith in God are waiting for the resurrection when they will be restored to the promised land in Sheol, while those who are wicked are in the shadowy waiting place, waiting for judgment to come upon them for the lives that they live. And to me, the key is that Sheol was never presented as the goal for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This was never the end of what they hoped for. This is where they would wait for the future restoration of the land that God had promised them. And interestingly, on top of Sheol, Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, and Jacob, those four alone are all given a distinct description of their resting place following their death in this world. That is given to no one else in the book of Genesis. So Abraham and his sons and his grandsons are all said to be gathered to his people. So this description for death is seen in Genesis 25:8, 25:17, 35:29, and 49:33. So no problem. So the phrase gathered to his people is a phrase for death in Genesis 25:8, 25:17, 35:29, and 49:33. Death is not to be seen as a restoration with God, but death is to be seen as a restoration with one's people. Sheol is a place where they would gather together to wait for God to fulfill his final promises to them. And to me, this also highlights and leads us into the importance of those burial practices in the promised land. Why are you going to want to be buried in the promised land? Because you believe I'm going to be waiting with my people for God to fulfill his promises in this land. So where do I want to be buried? I want to be buried with the people that I'm waiting with, where we're going to be waiting for the promise to be fulfilled. All of these go together really nice when you just simply look at all the death passages taken apart in the book of Genesis, and I think this is confirmed in other books in the Old Testament. I also think Jesus was speaking of this waiting place in the Gospel of Luke. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus tells us the story of Lazarus in Luke 16, 19 through 31. Jesus speaks of the rich man and a beggar named Lazarus. And initially, when they both die, it looks like that their fates are so radically different that clearly the rich man and Lazarus are in two completely different places. But then you end up seeing them communicating together while separated by a great gulf. And so I believe that Lazarus was gathered to his people. So he is with Abraham and his bosom, waiting on the fulfillment of the Lord through the promises of the Messiah. And the rich man is receiving the already torment that he deserves while still waiting for the final judgment of God. So Sheol, or the gathering place of people in death, pictures the souls of mankind as they await the final judgment of God, where God will either restore the faithful to the promised land that he has said he would deliver to them, or to judgment in the lake of fire. So Genesis begins to prepare God's people for the knowledge that what happens to us after death, that's not the permanent state. That is the temporary state as we wait for a physical fulfillment of what God has promised to us. So what Genesis does is it sets the groundwork for what we see at the end of the book of Revelation. And one of the interesting things about Revelation is that, I think any of you guys who have read, how many of you have read Revelation before, just to make sure I'm speaking to the choir here. All right. Jim didn't raise his hand. I'm hoping he has read it though. So in Revelation, obviously we get more descriptions of heaven in the book of Revelation than any other book. I mean, we have some dotted descriptions throughout the Old Testament, but as far as pictures of heaven in one place, we have more in Revelation than in any other book. And I don't know about you, but if I got to go to heaven and got some glimpse of it and then got to come down and, you know, tell people what it would look like, there's something I would probably talk about, and that is what my family was enjoying in heaven, what the people I knew were experiencing, and how wonderful it was to be faith to faith with Jesus Christ. I mean, I would be the greatest funeral speaker ever if I could get up and say, now let me tell you what people are enjoying in heaven right now, because I've seen it. Well, when John has the opportunity to see the glories of heaven, we notice two things. One, John has this very almost laser focus on the Lamb that is Jesus Christ, focusing on the Lamb's glory. But second, when he finally gets around to describing what some saints are doing in heaven, it's not really the picture that I would expect. This is what we have saints doing while they're in heaven. This is our only description of it. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And you would be thinking the next verse should be, and they were partying and celebrating because God has rewarded them for their faithfulness to be slain for his name. And it's so great for them in glory in heaven, face to face with Jesus Christ. But no, the next verse is them crying out with a loud voice saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth. So the saints in heaven, what are they doing in the one description that they have of them? They're saying, when are we going back to earth? I want to go back to this world. I am a descendant of Adam. I want to go back to the Adama. I want to get back on the ground, get back on the earth. Jesus, when will you lead us down? And so this focus on the world and on earth that we see in the book of Genesis, Revelation doesn't depart from that and give us this heavenly view of eternity, but Revelation actually goes right in line with what we see in the book of Genesis. So as a conclusion, God did not make us to live for eternity as spirits in heaven. God did not make us to have our own little cloud bank that we could sit on playing our harps all day, and that's eternity. No, God made us for this earth, and God has earthly plans for us in this world. And through God's own promises made to his friend Abraham, through the burial practices in the book of Genesis, through the very nature of the creation of Adam to live eternally on this world and not to die in this world and go to heaven, we see that we are to have an eternity in this world. And then, of course, since Genesis and Revelation were inspired by the same author, the Holy Spirit, we see at the end of Revelation that same longing to come back to earth and to have our eternity in this world as Christ will establish his kingdom in Jerusalem for the millennial kingdom, and then he will craft a new heaven and a new earth where the new Jerusalem will come to this world. So what we see is that when we think about eternity, when we think about the hope that we have in Jesus Christ, it should be an earthly hope. It should be it's probably not the best way to say it, but it should be a worldly hope, as in it should be on this world for eternity. And Genesis sets the stage for that. And I wish I could go back and talk to that rabbi again in DC and let him know, yes, the Jews had the best life for this world, but you need to understand, we're coming back to this world after we died. Like the Jews got it right that it is about life in this world, but that life is going to happen even after we leave this world in death, as it will be restored through the promises that God has made to his people. So that is what I got. So, and I'm thinking I left time for questions. So, okay. What time are we going till? 2:15. Yes. Right where I wanted to be. Okay. All right. Ladies first. So you're talking about the new heavens and the new earth?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
As far as the rewards, not so much the rewards, but just where we're going to be.
Okay. So I believe that the distinctions between Israel and the church, if that's what you're talking about, will remain distinct through the millennial kingdom. But they will no longer exist in the new heaven and new earth. Because when we look at the new Jerusalem, we see the foundation stones. I hope I'm saying this with the right people. The foundation stones, the 12 tribes of Israel, and the gates are the names of the 12 apostles. And I believe that that's the sign that's when the distinction no longer exists in the new heaven and the new earth and the new Jerusalem. So I think that God will view us as church and Israel, depending upon which age it was in that we came to faith in Jesus Christ. And in the eternal state, the new heaven and the new earth, that's when those distinctions will vanish. And I think we see that sign in the New Jerusalem with the apostles and the 12 tribes being joined together in the New Jerusalem.
There seems to be a growing interest in our culture in cremation. What is your perspective and the biblical perspective on like what you do with a body after death? Is there a proper thing we should do? Is there a biblical perspective on that?
So the question's on cremation. Is there a biblical perspective on cremation? This is where I would drive my pastor growing up, who I had for many years at my home church. I'd drive him crazy because he would teach on something like that and be like, see, we need to be buried. Like, look at the importance of the burial practices. I'm from the perspective of, you ain't going to find Abraham's body anywhere. It is dust now, and it is no longer existent. And I don't know how long till Jesus comes back. I would like to think he'd come back this afternoon. You know, let's do us a solid and come back, Lord. You know, we want that. But maybe he's got another 2,000 years. I don't know. And so because I take that kind of a view where it could be 2 days, it could be 2,000 years, I don't see an importance in burial or cremation. And I don't think that, I think if the Bible leans anyway, it is toward burial. But I don't see a huge, to me, it would be more of a heart issue. If you're cremating yourself as a sign that you don't believe anything's going to happen physically in this world, I'd have an issue with that. But if you still believe that you're going to be restored, then, you know, I don't think cremation's an issue. So in the back.
Yeah, and you just made a good presentation of how the burial was attached to the promise. So since it's not attached to the promise today with our cremation or burial, it doesn't have that same.
Yeah. So the question was about, since we're not under that same land promise, we don't have the same significance in burial. And I would agree the same way. Those land promises were specifically made to Abraham and to his descendants, whom, anybody in here Jewish? Hey, you know, you can get both promises from my perspective. So, in my opinion, if you're not Jewish, those will have other land in the world during the millennial kingdom to take care of. That's not in the promised land. So I don't think that the burial is as significant for us today. I did not, because it's not in Genesis.
But that had some sort of significance that the angel was disputing with the devil and said, the Lord rebuke you. But over the body, was that about where Moses would be buried?
So the question is about where Moses was buried and in Book of Jude, where they're fighting over his body. I have no comment. I don't know. It's one of those passages where I'm like, it's there, you know, it happened. And so, yeah, I don't have enough information around it. So did we have somebody else? Yeah, I put that along the same lines. Joseph had the same faith as Jacob, and I think, to me, Joseph's faith was more in, we'd been in Egypt all this time, and I want all of you to eventually get out of here. And so, to me, Joseph's was more specifically on, I just don't want to be buried there, here. I want all of you to leave from there. So, to me, Joseph had more of a faith in the entire nation to leave, and I mean, from Jacob's perspective, maybe they were going to leave Egypt in the next couple of years. He didn't know. But I think that by the time Joseph died, they were very settled in Egypt. And I think that Joseph made his specific command sort of as a way to kind of kick him in the bottom that you should get out of Egypt, which they didn't do and ended up not being the best thing. But I think it's the same type of faith. But Jacob's is personally focused and Joseph's looking at the whole family. Yeah.
And so he doesn't seem to be real worried about what's going to happen to him after he dies, you know? And I know we got to go, but what perspective or what insight might you offer for a situation like that, you know?
So the question was on reincarnation, which is what we've been talking about the whole time. Insight for reincarnation. I'd have to chew on that. I'm not sure. I guess I'm trying to think of what I talked about now and how that could relate to. I guess if I had to say anything, the one, I guess, advantage to not needing to worry about reincarnation is that if you mess things up in this life, it'll be bad in the next life, but maybe you could just make things better then. But I might emphasize more that this is just the one chance we have to make it right with God. And if we mess it up now, we're not going to have that second opportunity. And so, you know, you need to make it right with the Lord before death. And so... Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, I would think it was. All right, well, thank you for this time. Thank you for coming in. So.